The following podcast may contain spoilers.
Hello and welcome to Pat and Jason Have a Podcast, Season 1, Episode 7. I'm Pat.
And I'm Jason.
This is a show that looks at movies, sequels, reboots, franchises, and flops.
Every season we have a different movie theme, and in Season 1 we're ranking the best and the worst of famous movie franchises. Tonight's franchise, The Dark Knight Trilogy.
And we'll be reviewing Batman Begins, which currently holds a 85% on Rotten Tomatoes.
Pat and I are at present enjoying Stone Brewing's Pataskala Red X IPA. And I got IPA all over my pop filter.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Smells fruity.
Citrusy.
A nice bouquet of citrus and fruit.
This beer has an interesting story. The folks over at Stone Brewing, one of the co-founders was from Pataskala, Ohio, which I've never heard of. But the town's budget was being cut for music and art education, and he promised the town that they would pass a levy to support music and art in the education system, that he would brew a special beer named after the town. So they passed a levy in, I think, May, and in September, Stone Brewing brewed this wonderful citrusy red IPA. People liked it so much, and it sold so well, that they decided to make it a seasonal thing. So in February 1st of 2016, they released it as part of their spring seasonal beer releases. You can get it in six packs and on draft at fine watering holes all across America. And it's of course an Indian pale ale. Hop varieties are Amarillo, Cascade, Mosaic. Pat and I aren't really IPA guys.
Yeah, this is actually really good.
Yeah, it's pretty good. It's not too bitter, which no. IPAs are famous for being bitter. They're an acquired taste.
Yeah, that's why I don't like them. I don't like the bitter.
Yeah. This is more of like a citrus forward sort of profile, so it's a pretty good like spring beer. Grapefruity maybe a little bit.
Well, yeah, I get the grapefruit right there.
Yeah, kind of a little bit of a sweet and just a hint of bitterness. So if you are an IPA fan or you're a music and arts education fan, go ahead and check out Stone Brewing's Pataskala Red X IPA. It's pretty good.
Endorsed by Pat News.
Officially endorsed by two nerds on a podcast.
Jason, what's the history of this franchise?
Following the critical failure and box office disappointment of Batman and Robin, Warner Brothers rebooted the film franchise. The trilogy stars Christian Bale as Bruce Wayne and Batman, Michael Caine as Alfred Pennyworth, Gary Oldman as James Gordon, and Morgan Freeman as Lucius Fox. Each film in the series was a box office success, in particular the second and third films, which both earned over $1 billion worldwide. In addition, the trilogy has gained widespread recognition as being the crowning achievement of the superhero genre. Following a rejected Batman origin story Joss Whedon pitched in December 2002, Warner Brothers hired Christopher Nolan and David S. Goyer to script Batman Begins. The duo aimed for a darker and more realistic tone, with humanity and realism being the basis of the film. The film relied on traditional stunts and scale models with minimal use of computer-generated imagery. Christian Bale starred as Batman, Liam Neeson starred as Ra's al Ghul, and Cillian Murphy as the Scarecrow. Katie Holmes also starred in the movie as Bruce's love interest Rachel Dawes, a role created for the film. A new Batmobile called the Tumbler and a more mobile Batsuit were both created specifically for the film. Batman Begins opened on June 15, 2005 in the United States and Canada in 3,858 theaters. The film grossed $48 million in its opening weekend, eventually grossing over $372 million worldwide, and was nominated for the Academy Award for Best Cinematography. Nolan reprised his duties as director and brought his brother Jonathan Nolan to co-write the script for the second installment, The Dark Knight, which featured Bale reprising his role as Batman and Bruce Wayne, Heath Ledger as the Joker, and Aaron Eckhart as Harvey Dent and Two-Face. Principal photography began in April 2007 in Chicago and concluded in November. Other locations included Pinewood Studios, Ministry of Sound in London, and Hong Kong. On January 22, 2008, after he completed filming The Dark Knight, Ledger died from a combination of prescription medication. Warner Brothers had created a viral marketing campaign for The Dark Knight, developing promotional websites and trailers highlighting screenshots of Ledger as the Joker. But after Ledger's death, the studio refocused its promotional campaign. The film made use of IMAX cameras, most notably during the bank heist, the hospital explosion, and the SWAT caravan scene, where only one of three IMAX cameras at the time was destroyed in a crash. The film set numerous records during its theatrical run, with over $1 billion in revenue worldwide. It is the 16th highest-grossing film of all time, unadjusted for inflation. The film received 8 Academy Award nominations. It won the award for Best Sound Editing, and Ledger was posthumously awarded Best Supporting Actor. Nolan wanted the story for the third film and final installment to keep him emotionally invested. On a more superficial level, I have to ask the question, he reasoned. How many good third movies in a franchise can people name? By December 2008, Nolan completed a rough story outline before he committed himself to Inception. In February 2010, work on the screenplay was commencing with David S. Goyer and Jonathan Nolan. When Goyer left to work on the Superman reboot, Jonathan was writing the script based on the story by his brother and Goyer. Tom Hardy was cast as Bane, and Anne Hathaway plays Selina Kyle. Joseph Gordon-Levitt was cast as John Blake, and Marion Cotillard was cast as Miranda Tate. Filming began in May 2011 and concluded in November. Nolan chose not to film in 3D, instead focusing on improving image quality and scale using the IMAX format, and hoped to push technological boundaries while nevertheless making the style of the film consistent with the previous two. The Dark Knight Rises went on to outgross both its predecessors and became the 14th highest-grossing film of all time, grossing over $1.08 billion. However, unlike its predecessors, the film was not nominated for any awards. All right, Pat, this is the normal part of the show where you and I talk about our personal histories with the franchise. What are your thoughts about this trilogy?
You get a very different perspective of Batman that we've never seen really on film. I guess Burton tried to do it in his franchise, but I mean, this is a more darker, grittier Batman. More serious and less camp. I don't think there's really hardly any jokes in the movie, except maybe Alfred throwing a quip here or there. They kind of like draw, like they put the weight on you. Like I said, I think it's a good story, kind of stretching across the three movies.
Even though I've watched Batman Returns and probably Batman 89 yearly, I haven't watched these in years. I think the answer is exactly what you were saying is, they're not fun movies.
No, yeah, but they're visually cool to look at.
They're super well made.
Yeah.
They're probably, not probably, they are superior films, just from a filmmaking perspective. I think the thing to remember, though, is, you know, you were talking about the differences in tone and stuff is, I think what you're seeing, you know, say like Batman 89 or Batman Returns, that is what dark was in the late 80s, early 90s, and the tone of post 9/11 Batman Begins, and especially The Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises, is very much the tone of what dark looks like for the Western world in the 21st century. I mean, we have distrust with our politicians and fear of terrorism and economic issues, and we've had a lot corruption of stuff. Yeah.
Just all this
kind of all this heaviness in our collective psyche as you know, Americans and the Western civilization. And that kind of has crept its way into that. Those movies. Those movies are sort of on the pulse of the paranoia, the fear, the chaos, the neuroses of, you know, I don't know, like, a, you know, a post-terrorist world, I guess. I mean, terrorism's been around for a long time, but
it's more in the forefront recently.
Today, yeah.
In today's world.
Yeah, yeah. Especially in comparison to, like, 1989 or something. So our fears are different in the 21st century than they were at the end of the 20th century. We just have a different set of fears, and I think that those movies tap into that. When was the last time you've seen The Dark Knight and before this show, and what were your thoughts going back to look at it now? Almost, it's hard to believe, almost a decade later, 8 years later.
Yeah, I think a lot of the thing was about that movie was Heath Ledger's performance in the movie. I think that blew everybody away.
Yeah, it was phenomenal.
Like, I remember him, like, when he was cast, and everybody's like, that's a horrible idea. This is the worst idea in the world. The guy from A Knight's Tale doing the Joker, and it was just like an amazing performance by him. I still think it's a good movie. I think it's maybe diminished a little bit in my eyes because, you know, I've seen it probably a handful of times, and the performance kind of, it's still good, but it doesn't surprise me anymore because I know it.
That first time in 2008 when you're watching the movie and the Hans Zimmer score, which was specifically designed to be ratcheting up tension. I mean, even like the notes that were played, the amount of tension that they had on the strings that they were playing, it increases. So it's like a higher and higher pitch and
gets your blood pumping.
Yeah.
It's puts just you on the edge of your seat, kind of like, oh, what's going to happen?
It's crafted to be tense. And there's some unexpected things that happen and some deaths that occur out of nowhere. And you think it's going to go one way and it goes another. And that's the perfect sort of tone and pacing and sense that you should have in a movie about the Joker. But once you realize where the story is going to go, and it's only going to go so far, there is a little bit of a diminishing returns on the movie, because you know it's not going to, you know, Batman's not going to die, or the city's not going to blow up. You know.
Yeah, that tension's kind of relieved a bit. You're more relaxed, so you don't have that same experience. You don't have that same like pumping flop sweat going on.
Right. And it's a long movie. Each of these movies is longer by 10 minutes. Batman Begins is like 2 hours and 20 minutes. This one, Dark Knight's 2 hours and 30 minutes. And then the last one's like 2 hours and 40 minutes. So they added 10 minutes to the running time in each film. And I think without some of that tension, you feel a little bit more of the length of the film. I noticed that watching it again.
I do agree with you. I think you do feel the length of the movie more, especially in Rises. That one, I felt the length more. Like, I'm just sitting there like, I know what's going to happen. And I'm just kind of like, I'm just waiting for it to end.
It's not as tight of a script, which is the issue. It's not the Dark Knight, if you were to look at it from like a screenplay perspective, is a very tight screenplay. There's obviously a couple of, there's some loopholes here and there. There's some continuity stuff. There's some stuff that's like,
nitpicky stuff.
I also think the problem with the Dark Knight, I had it then and I still have it now, is there's no reason for Batman to take the blame for the crimes of Harvey Dent.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And if the argument is, well, we need Batman to be a vigilante for the third film, that's problematic for two reasons. One, he's not a vigilante really in the third film, because according to the third film, he hasn't been seen since that night.
Yeah.
That movie sets up this idea that Batman's going to be chased.
Yeah, he's going to endure.
I will chase you.
Yeah.
You know, you'll endure. And he doesn't.
No, he just disappears. Not only quits Batman, quits being Bruce Wayne.
But the second reason that's problematic is you could just as easily continue this idea of Batman's a vigilante for the third film, if that's what you want to do, because the city blames him for the Joker.
Yeah, for escalation.
That was the point of the second movie. It's not like people's emotions are going to change in a dime. People wanted the Batman to turn himself in because cops were being killed in the streets and civilians were being killed and the whole city was under this terrorist attack because of Batman. That's not going to change just because they captured the Joker.
Well, I mean, in the beginning of this movie, the Dark Knight, they're supposed to be hunting the vigilante Batman, but they're not. So instead of not doing it, they'll be doing it.
Yeah, that's like, right. This is a thing that I've noticed in a lot of Christopher Nolan films, and his brother, Jonathan Nolan, writes a lot of the movies that he directs, or they work on them together. So I noticed that in a lot of their movies, there's this consistent pattern where the third act, or like the second part of the third act, kind of unravels a little bit. I think they're really good at building a movie up and building a world up and build. They're not as good at paying the story off. And if you look at the Dark Knight trilogy as one story, The Dark Knight Rises is the third act.
Should be
the third and act. That's the most problematic out of the trilogy. Like Interstellar, we're not talking about it, but it's a pretty good movie. And then the third act, and it's like, oh boy. And you know, it's like in all of these Nolan movies, you just feel the movie start wobbling. You know, it's like the very tight, very well constructed movies, and then you get into that third act and you can, it's like the whole thing, like it's like a plane that just starts shaking, you know, you're like, oh, this thing's gonna come apart.
You're going too fast. Shaking apart. Engine two's gone out. Engine three, we're going down.
They're really good at building these worlds, but they're not good at seeing the story through in a way like where it can hold the weight of what they've built.
I think the problem might be for them is they're such good storytellers that they're in a time constraint. Like they have to put these movies in a box and then they might have too long of a story.
That's a really good point, because I felt like going to Dark Knight Rises, I felt that was three or four Batman movies crammed into one. Like the story of Bane and Talia. Well, first of all, Gotham being taken over in a siege of Gotham. That's a movie.
Yeah, that would be.
That's a plot line of a movie. Batman going into what is their version of the Lazarus Pit, the prison, and having to be reborn and come back and save the city. That's a movie. That doesn't even have to be tied to the siege plot. Yeah. That's a movie.
Under siege.
That's a movie. The League of Shadows throws Batman in a pit to come out, and he has to be resurrected to come out of it. That's a movie. The whole Batman Catwoman thing and Daggett, that could have been a movie.
Maybe it's possible they had all these great script ideas and they just started like throwing pieces there.
Well, the thing is, we talked about in the history of and Nolan basically was afraid that he was going to get bored with doing a sequel. And so like halfway through the production of the film, made some major changes because he didn't want to just do another Batman movie. So he wanted to do something bigger and more grand and had a lot of these ideas. And so I think it is one of those instances where it's like, I don't want to just do Batman movies forever because I don't want to get stuck. I kind of want to get it all in there because this is the only time that we'll all be together to make these movies. So while we've got this cast and we've got this crew and we've got this story, let's just finish it. But I honestly think that they had more stories to tell. I think they could have done. I think The Dark Knight Rises, the Siege of Gotham and Bane and all that, that probably should have been like the fifth movie.
Yeah, they could have done, yeah, two more movies.
Yes.
Three at the top. Yeah, I get it too. It's counterproductive for his creative process. Like he wants to be creative. He wants to do other things and expand his creativity and go to new worlds.
As far as the story that's been told to us in the first two films, there's nothing that would make me believe that this Bruce Wayne would quit being Batman. This Bruce Wayne would quit being Bruce Wayne, especially in rewatching Batman Begins, because Alfred has to convince him to beat Bruce Wayne. And Bruce has no interest in it. He only wants to be Batman. In The Dark Knight, Alfred is constantly trying to tell him, know your limits. And in this movie, you could be doing more as Bruce Wayne. So I think it would have made more sense in the beginning of The Dark Knight Rises that Bruce Wayne became a recluse after the loss of Rachel Dawes and Harvey Dent, his friends, his childhood love. He's also been, there's rumors that he's been working on this clean energy thing, and for some reason he just stopped, and nobody knows why, and nobody has seen him in 10 years. I wouldn't have done 8, I've done 10. Nobody's seen him in 10 years, but Batman's been working this entire time up to a year ago, and I would have made it that Bruce doubled down on being Batman and is shattered. His whole body is shattered. He cannot go anymore.
Which would go in lines with Rises and him going to the doctor.
Yes.
Because so far we've only seen him as Batman for 1 year.
Yeah, he needs to have like 10 years of abuse. And so he's been gone for a year and he's been spending that year trying to rebuild himself. And not to be Bruce Wayne, but so he can get back out there to be Batman. And Alfred would feel this guilt of he's destroyed himself on a lie by omission because I didn't tell him that Rachel rejected him. And so he's not only now fueled by the vengeance of his parents, he's fueled by getting vengeance for her. It's only going to send him deeper into the Batman demon. And I think the connection there is, we'll touch on this in Batman Begins, Batman is the son of Ra's al Ghul. Bruce Wayne is the son of Thomas Wayne. Because Ra's al Ghul means the head of the demon. And Batman is a demon. He's a gargoyle come to life. He's men's fears come to life. He's Bruce Wayne's demon.
Yeah, his greatest fear.
And in this universe, Ra's created that, cultivated that. It's not your fault. It's your father's fault. Your father was too weak. You have to have the will. He remade him in his own image. Batman's gauntlets, everything he does, all of his theatrics, all of his fear, all of his ninjutsu, it's all League of Shadows in this universe.
In this universe, yeah, it's all.
So he is the son, a spiritual son of Ra's al Ghul. And Ra's was...
He was going to make him...
Make him the heir.
Yeah.
You're going to lead these men. So the movie should have been, because the first movie is really about his relationship with his father. This whole trilogy is really about the loss of his father. The mother's almost not even mentioned. Did you notice that?
Yeah, they just never...
It's always flashbacks to the dad, why did we fall, getting him out of the well, Bruce.
Barely see
the mother,
Martha, yeah, in there at all.
Don't be afraid. All this sort of stuff. It's all him. It's all his dad.
Does she even have a line?
So in The Dark Knight Rises, it should have been the death of Batman, the son of Ra's al Ghul, and the resurrection of Bruce Wayne. And the beginning should have been Bruce Wayne is dead, and he's all Batman. He's all the demon. The demon has consumed him. But it's Bruce Wayne who's resurrected, and Bruce Wayne picks up his father's mantle to rebuild the city, because that's what his father was doing.
Yeah, he's trying to save the city.
Dark Knight Rises is really a love story. Not a romance. It's a love story. It's the love between a father and a son, a father figure and a son, Alfred and Bruce, Thomas Wayne and Bruce. The love between Bane and Talia. Bane loves her romantically. She doesn't love him that way, but he'll do anything for her. But she has some affection for him as a protector.
But she's willing to sacrifice him.
Oh, yeah. Because she doesn't really love him. That's hook.
It's like, you can die.
But he loves her so much, he'll do it.
Yeah.
That's the hook. The love between a father and a daughter. Because she screwed up because her father rejected her because of Bane. And chose Bruce to be the heir instead of her. And left her in that hole that he didn't know about. The love between Roz and his wife. It's all love. Every point is love. It's Bruce.
And then Bruce and
Rachel. His unrequited love. Then,
and then Bruce and Selina.
Bruce and Miranda Tate and Batman and Selina Kyle.
There's so, love all over.
There is. So the end of the movie is the death of Talia.
Worst death
ever. Yeah, it was a terrible death. But the death of Talia. And then Bruce ends up with Selina in Florence. And that's a terrible ending. But it should have ended where Bruce can only be with Selina if he's Batman, but Batman is dead. So even though he loves her, there's no place for them in each other's lives, which is the traditional Catwoman Batman story. So she disappears to get a fresh start. So he has to sacrifice that love so that he can be Bruce Wayne. The Miranda Tate character, part of the issue is we're supposed to really care about these two love interests. They don't. There's so much story in the story. We don't have time to develop those characters and bond with them. So it doesn't feel sad or shocking when Miranda betrays him. We should feel that betrayal. We don't. In hindsight, they probably should have introduced her in the second movie. Selina, even though there's a great performance and it's a fun character and she does a great job, we don't really know anything about her either. We know a little bit more, but not much. And there's nothing in that movie that would make us believe that these two are going to end up together in this perfect relationship.
Yeah, there's really nothing.
Imagine this ending. Selina leaves. She gets her clean slate. Miranda's dead. Gotham is in ruins. They build a statue for Batman because he sacrifices himself to save the city. Bruce Wayne comes out of being a recluse. It's the first time anybody's seen him in 10 years. And he addresses the people of Gotham. That the city's been through hell and it needs to be rebuilt. And Wayne, the Wayne Foundation, Wayne Enterprises, Wayne Tech, whatever it is in these movies or all of the above, is going to be at the forefront of rebuilding the city. And imagine him and Lucius Fox and Alfred going and pulling out old plans that the Wayne Foundation had that were designed by Thomas Wayne himself, of his original vision of what Gotham could be after the first Depression. And they're finally going to rebuild Gotham in the image of his father, and the first project would be rebuilding the monorail from the Batman Begins that was destroyed.
That would be a better circle.
Then imagine Bruce at the unveiling with Gordon, and they don't really know each other, but Bruce goes to Gordon, and Gordon has that line, you know, I never really cared who he was, but I wish I would have known who saved the city. And then that's when Bruce delivers the line. Sometimes a hero is just somebody puts a coat on the shoulders of whatever, walks away. Bruce Wayne? Imagine it's a more personal moment. You could end up in a very similar place. And then you could still have John Blake discover the Batcave. I wouldn't call him Robin. I wouldn't have Bruce give him the stuff. But just imagine, he's already figured it out. And imagine at the last scene is him finding the Batcave on his own and rising up. So he wouldn't be Batman, but he'd, you know, be a vigilante or whatever. How would you rank these movies?
See, this is tough because you're trying to rank three movies separately, but they're actually like connected in almost one story.
Right.
So it's really hard to like, oh, this one's better than this one, because it's in the core of it, one giant story. But for me, if put a gun to my head in the bunker, I'm going to go with The Dark Knight, Batman Begins, and then Rises. That's how I'd... Yeah, but to be really honest, like, The Dark Knight and Batman Begins are pretty really close, like, almost neck and neck. I really enjoyed Batman Begins.
I would put Batman Begins first, only for this reason. It's a better Batman movie.
I agree.
The Dark Knight is a better film, which maybe that's a cheat, because we're a movie podcast, and we're not a Batman podcast, so we're supposed to be like, what's the better
movie?
Film. The Dark Knight is the better film, but it isn't a better Batman movie. And I would say the best Batman movie to date is Batman Begins.
It is a better Batman story.
And now looking back, I like The Dark Knight. I like parts of The Dark Knight Rises. I like Tom Hardy. I like Anne Hathaway. I like parts of all of the disparate stories that they're telling. It's just the whole thing doesn't quite come together for me as well as the other two. So I would say Batman Begins, The Dark Knight, and then The Dark Knight Rises. And I think The Dark Knight Rises with a better ending, or an ending that makes more sense to the movies in the world that the movie set up previously.
Yeah, it ties them in a whole.
Would really bump that one up.
Do you piss green after you've eaten vitamins? We certainly do, and therefore you should listen to the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews podcast.
Even if you don't piss green, isn't something I think you guys will like if you like TV and you like movies?
We count down lists associated with both, as well as offer the occasional review and a number of segments that are random in nature for your enjoyment.
Check out the Countdown Movie and TV Reviews on iTunes, Podomatic, or your favorite podcast app.
Tell us, Mr. Wayne. What do you fear?
How do you know my name?
The world is too small for someone like Bruce Wayne to disappear.
Your parents' death was not your fault.
My parents deserve justice.
I cannot let that pass. If you make yourself more than just a man, then you become something else entirely.
Which is?
A legend, Mr. Wayne.
Master Wayne,
are you coming back for long, sir?
As long as it takes to show the people of Gotham their city doesn't belong to the criminals and the corrupt.
Bruce?
Rachel?
You were gone a long time.
Yeah.
Things are worse than ever down here. What chance does Gotham have when the good people do nothing?
No makes a viable suit for advanced infantry.
Kevlar utility harness, gas-powered magnetic grapple gun.
What's that?
I'm on the tumbler? Oh, you wouldn't be interested in that.
I spent a lot of time being scared for you. I heard you were back. The man who vanished never came back.
He's here. Who? The Batman.
Gotham must be destroyed.
Gotham isn't beyond saving.
Just hold on!
Dresses up like a bat, clearly has issues.
So how'd you feel about Christian Bale as Batman?
I especially liked him in this movie. I think he did really good in this movie as being both Batman and Bruce Wayne.
I agree with you on that one. I think his Batman voice could have been better. In this movie, in Batman Begins, it's probably the best out of the
yeah.
But it's still like somebody just put a pile of rocks in his mouth. I don't know. So Michael Caine is Alfred.
We talked about the fact that we grew up with a different Alfred. It's a great performance.
And he is a different Alfred in this. Like, he does different. Like, he's more involved, it seems. Liam Neeson as Ducard.
Liam Neeson is a great character actor.
He's like a legend.
Previous to 2005, I never would have pictured him as Ra's al Ghul. But he did a great job. It's a great performance. I think he pulls off. He plays what could have been a very ridiculous villain in a very earnest way. And I think his performance is what helps lend credibility to everything else that follows. If the League of Shadows or Ra's al Ghul or any of that had been really corny, it wouldn't have worked, because that's what sets the groundwork for the believability of the rest of it.
Yeah.
So I think his performance is pretty key. He's evil, but he also comes off as someone who doesn't know he's evil. And the best villains are the ones that don't think they are villains.
Thinks they're doing good, but doing evil.
Yep.
Yeah, he pulls off maniacal pretty well. I don't know. I love Liam Neeson. I think even in bad movies, he pulls off a really good performance. All right, so we got the legend Gary Oldman.
Gary Oldman has been in some bad movies.
He's been in
Lost in Space.
I forgot about that. Yeah. That is a bad movie.
My favorite Gary Oldman performance is in Leon the Professional. Everyone!
he's the classic character actor that, like, you lose Gary Oldman in the performance. Like, he takes on this character and becomes that character.
A Liam Neeson and a Gary Oldman is a better actor than probably 10 actors today.
Well, we got Morgan Freeman. You know, this is the first time we see Lucius Fox on screen.
Yeah.
And I couldn't think of a better actor to play Lucius Fox.
Morgan Freeman isn't like a Gary Oldman where he disappears into the characters.
No, yeah, he's character is a Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, he's pretty much the same in everything that you see. Some of his, when he was younger, some of that he was, but this older, this stage of his career,
like ever since Shawshank Redemption, kind of.
Yes. Yeah.
He's been that character that narrates your life and you enjoy it.
Yeah. And has a sense of gravitas and all that. Yeah.
Cillian Murphy as the Scarecrow / Dr. Crane.
I think he gives a really good performance. He's menacing. He's creepy. He's disturbing. That's what he's supposed to be. Fine.
You know what? Like we've said in other things, like this person is this character for us forever. Cillian Murphy is the Scarecrow for me forever. Katie Holmes.
She stunk.
Yeah. She's
a cutie, but which is like such a misogynistic thing. I can only judge, she's a woman, so I can only judge her performance by her, how attractive I find her.
She was emotionless for me. Like, very, very just kind of like monotone.
I'll tell you what the difference is. The rest of these people came off as movie actors. She came off as a television actor.
Yeah. She was, like Dawson's Creek, and she did some other, like.
And I don't mean that as a knock, but there's people, acting for television, acting for film. Are different skill sets.
Yeah.
So she might be better. She's a little bit older now, and she's a mom. She, like,
held captive by Tom Cruise for a while.
I wouldn't know anything about being held captive by a cult. I will comply. I will be a good boy. I will behave.
Yes, sir. Thank you, sir. May I have another, sir?
Pat and I are going clear. I think she's definitely the weakest part of the movie. The weakest part from a performance standpoint.
You may disagree with this, but I think. Joan Hall was a little bit better choice. Like, I liked her performance better in the second one than as a character.
I didn't think that Maggie Gyllenhaal was an appropriate casting decision for the character of Rachel Dawes. Oh, come on, Harvey. You're not doing your job unless somebody's trying to kill you. It's just, it's bad. It's a bad scene. Her death is almost comical.
Almost. But like I said, I think Joan Hall just gave a little bit better performance than.
She's a better actress, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, on to the movie. So Batman Begins, 2005 movie, and it opens up with a combination of flashbacks. It's a dream sequence, flashback, young Bruce Wayne, young Rachel Dawes, they're on Wayne Manor. Bruce falls into a hole, and he breaks his legs, and he's traumatized by bats. He wakes up, he's in this nondescript Asian, I guess, somewhere around maybe Nepal.
Yeah, I would say more mountain region.
Yeah, it's unidentified Asia.
Yes, I mean, Asia is a very vast
continent. Yeah.
Very vast continent.
And he's in prison, and he is getting in a fight with prisoners, and he's thrown into solitary confinement where he's confronted by Liam Neeson, who plays Ducard. And Ducard knows who he is, and Ducard gives this great line, which totally undercuts The Dark Knight Rises. The world is too small for someone like Bruce Wayne to simply disappear. And basically, we find out through this exchange that after the death of his parents, Bruce grew up, went to college, was kicked out of college, and
I think he just left college. I don't think he was kicked out.
No, he was.
Was he?
He said, "I like it there. They don't like me there."
Okay.
He was kicked out of Princeton.
Yeah, that's right.
And rather than stay in Gotham, he basically decided to travel the world and to learn become a part of the criminal element to figure out what made them tick. Because his parents' murderer, who isn't the Joker in this movie,
he's not the Joker. Yes.
Is Joe Chill.
Joe Chill.
Joe Chill was up for a parole hearing because he was willing to turn state's evidence
against on Falcone,
who's one of the big mob bosses of Gotham.
Yeah, he's the godfather.
Bruce sees this as an injustice. This man killed my parents. You're going to let him out early because he's willing to give you a bigger fish.
Yeah.
Bruce decides to kill him.
Yeah,
he was
planning to kill him.
He goes to the hearing.
Which is, I'm surprised he was able to get a gun into
the courthouse.
The courthouse.
Yeah. Actually, I know this, but not all of them have metal detectors. I would assume the one in Gotham would.
Yeah, with the rampant crime going on.
Right, but not all of them do. So he sneaks a gun into the courthouse, and he's going to kill him. But before he can, somebody sent from the mob comes up and says, Falcone says hello, and shoots him. And so he's unable to take his vengeance. He then reconnects with Rachel Dawes, who was a childhood friend and who now works at the district attorney's office. She's like an assistant prosecutor.
Yeah, ADA.
Basically, she confronts him as to there's a difference between vengeance and justice.
Yeah, she's trying to like explain it to him why this happened, why they let Chill go, and then more explaining to what happened, why he's...
Well, she's trying to get him to see that his pain is real, but the whole city's in pain.
Yeah, it's not just about you. We're trying to heal Gotham.
And they actually, there's a really neat scene where they're kind of in this clean, urban, metropolitan, Chicago-y area, and then they just go one layer beneath, and it's rotten. It's the gutter. It's basically... The new Gotham is just built over top of the old Gotham, but people still live in the old Gotham and they're poor. And Gotham had been through this horrible depression. Everybody thinks the depression's over, but it really isn't. Most of Gotham is still feeling the effects of that economic depression. And the mob is preying on them because of it.
Yeah, the mob's thriving.
Yep.
And just feeding on this desperation.
So the metaphorical underground or underbelly of Gotham is also a literal physical underbelly and underground. Bruce confesses to her that his plan all along was to kill Joe Chill. That's why he was there. He wasn't there for the sake of standing up for the Waynes or speaking on their behalf or justice. He was there for vengeance. She slaps him in the face, tells him your father would be ashamed of you, and dumps him off at Carmine Falcone's club, which is in the bottoms.
Says go thank him. There he is. That's where Falcone is. Go.
And kind of in essence, like you're no better than him.
Yeah, saying what you were planning to do, he did it.
He walks in. Carmine says, if you wanted to thank me, you just could send a note or flowers or something like that. He's real condescending towards him.
Yeah.
And he says, you come in here with all of your anger and you think you know the dirty side of life. You don't know. Ba-da-da-da-da. That was a great line.
Yeah, you don't know desperation.
Yeah. You don't know desperation. So get out of here. And they basically rough Bruce up. That line is Bruce's motivation for traveling the world and becoming a criminal. Because he basically tells him, you don't know what it is to be desperate,
you don't know what it's to want for anything.
Yes.
Everything's provided for you.
And he takes off and he travels the world with the criminal element. He just joins the lower parts of society to know desperation, to learn the criminal mind. And he's found himself in this prison. And Ducard, who's played by Liam Neeson, offers him an opportunity that if he's going to be let out of prison, which I assume he orchestrated.
Yeah, it had to mean bribes, you know.
He's going to be dropped off in the middle of nowhere if he's willing to climb a mountain and find this one particular flower and then take that flower to the top of the mountain, he'll get what he's looking for. And he asked Bruce what he's looking for, and he's looking for...
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what he said when he was looking for it.
What are you looking for, Mr. Wayne? I'm looking for a way to fight injustice and to turn my fear against those who prey on the fearful. And when he gets there, it turns out that Ducard is part of this league of assassins, this league of ninjas.
Yeah.
It sounds so ridiculous when you lay it out.
Yes. I think,
but it's played so earnestly, yeah, isn't it?
Like the League of Shadows, like that's your name.
Well, it's okay. The funny thing about it is, if you lay this out, it's ridiculous. Like just hearing myself say these things is stupid. But Nolan does such a good job, and this movie in particular does such a good job laying out the logic every step of the way.
Yeah, I mean,
so it never feels ludicrous.
I think that's what the thing we're saying with like every scene has so much information and it's leading on to the next scene and it's just driving this whole story. So yeah, so, it doesn't. You don't have that point of this is ridiculous and this is totally insane. You believe it. You're into this story because it makes sense as it's being told to you.
And it starts in a fairly logical place
when he's young,
and then it adds a little sort of line of logic, like, well, this is how we can get from this realistic thing to this slightly less realistic to slightly less realistic. So by the time we're at the end and we're in a full-blown comic book movie, or even maybe even like halfway through, we're in a full-blown comic book movie, it doesn't feel like such a leap.
Yeah.
It feels like it's slow progression.
Gradual build to Batman.
Ducard takes on Bruce essentially as his apprentice. and puts him through all of these different trials and tests and trainings and is trying to teach him how to master fear.
Yeah.
And
not just fear, your own fears.
And he's teaching him ninjutsu and how to be invisible in plain sight and all of this sort of stuff that will later become Batman. Now, what did you think of this whole sequence, this whole first half hour, 40 minutes that happens around the League of Shadows? This was addressed in comic books. In Batman Year One, there was some of this, you know, ninja training.
Yeah.
But this is the first cinematic version of Batman where we're given any sort of logic as to how he can do what he does. Do you like this? Does this make sense to you that he's a ninja, basically?
Actually, yeah, it does make sense to me. I did like it. Actually, this is the first time we see on film the basically an origin of Batman. Like, 89 is just, he is Batman.
We get the sense in 89 that it's like fairly new.
Yeah.
And he's just started being Batman.
It's a myth of Batman, but you don't see his origins where he got his skills and building the Batcave.
Yes.
And all this stuff and getting the car.
Yeah.
So, I mean, with this, you see that. It's like you go along with Bruce on this journey to become Batman.
Yeah. You can visually see where he would have extrapolated, like, I started off as a ninja, I'm going to become this bat figure because that's the symbol of his fear. When he, you know, that goes back to that very first image we see of him falling down the well, breaking his leg, and he's attacked by bats or bats swarm.
Yeah.
And so he's terrified of bats. And bats specifically lead to the death. He goes to the opera with his family, and there's bats in the opera, and he gets terrified of the bats because he's traumatized by them. So his dad and mom rush him out of the opera, and that's when Joe Chill finds him in the alley and kills them for their money. He has guilt about fear, and he has guilt about his parents' death. He blames himself for his parents' death because of his fear of bats.
Yeah, because, you know, another thing, this little origin story that we get in pretty much like the first third of the movie, first third, it also shows you Batman as like a real person. He's not this superhero figure that you're used to seeing. So
right.
He's a real person first. And it kind of grounds Batman down to he's just a man.
Yes.
Not a superhero, a bigger than legend kind of figure.
Eventually what comes to pass is the League of Shadows has this farmer who has killed his neighbor basically for his stuff, for his land and for his cattle and whatever. And the final test, after all of this training and all this sort of stuff, Ducard, we should say too, the whole time Ducard is training him, but Ra's al Ghul is basically on a throne kind of overseeing this. So Ducard is kind of Ra's al Ghul's right-hand guy.
Yeah.
And so Ra's speaks some sort of a gibberish that Ducard interprets. It's Ken Watanabe, who was also in Godzilla.
Godzilla, yes.
Let them fight. And was in Inception.
Yes,
yeah.
Inception.
Yes. So he's a good actor, and he's really good at those mysterious sort of roles. They want Bruce as his final test. He has to prove to them that he can execute justice. And in this case, they want him. This is a criminal. This is a murderer. And, you know, justice won't, the justice system won't do anything for this man. True justice is chopping this guy's head off.
Eye for an eye. He killed, so we need to kill him.
You pass this test, you will prove that you can lead these men, because he's been groomed to basically be the heir of the League of Shadows. Like, the only thing that keeps in this universe, and actually in a lot of different Batman stuff, the only thing that keeps Batman from being a complete psychopath like the Joker or a murderer is his father. It's the Thomas Wayne in him that modeled for him and taught him to care for other people.
Be a better man.
And be a better man. So that's the only thing that keeps him from crossing that line.
And it also shows that Ducard in the League of Shadows hasn't ripped everything from Bruce. They haven't broke him down completely. And his guilt hasn't completely gone away either. It's still there.
Yep.
It's like his foundation is his father and his guilt.
Turns out the League of Shadows are basically terrorists.
Yeah.
They have a very warped sense of justice.
Yeah.
Their sense of justice is, if there's injustice,
we'll just destroy everything.
You destroy everything.
Burn it to the ground.
Kind of the real reason why they found him and trained him and brainwashed him to some extent, is they want him to lead the League of Shadows back into Gotham to destroy it. Bruce, in return, refuses to kill the man, refuses the League to lead the League of Nations, believes that Gotham can be saved.
League of Shadows, not Nations.
League of Shadows. He puts his sword into a fire, and there's like a branding iron there, and he flips the branding iron into gunpowder, and... kills a lot of people.
Yeah, I'm not going to kill this one guy.
But I'll kill everybody.
But I'll kill all you guys.
Yeah, he does. He kills everybody.
He kills a lot of people.
Some beams fall down. Ra's al Ghul is killed. Him and Dukar get into a fight, and then they're blown. The building blows up, and they're blown off onto like a
little precipice,
a mountain precipice, and go sliding down the ice.
It's a cool shot, but.
Physically impossible.
Physically impossible. Yeah, they're boogie boarding down this mountain cliff.
And Liam Neeson's totally passed out.
Yeah, he's just like...
unconscious.
Yeah, he's a slab of meat just sliding down this mountain hill. Yeah, and like, he gets to the point, like, he goes over the edge and Bruce goes over the edge and grabs him with one arm and then takes his other arm and like, because he has those gauntlets with the hooks and like...
Hooks himself in the ice.
Yeah, hooks him in the ice. But with all of like Liam Neeson's weight, you're going to be in extreme pain, and I don't think he's going to be able to hold him with one hand.
But he does.
He does.
He lifts him up, he saves him, and he takes him to a nearby village and basically says, take care of this guy.
It was an interesting cut, too, because like he pulls him back up, too, and like gets him like halfway up, and then it cuts. Yeah. So they're like, how did he get him dressed up?
So, but he finds out that the company his father started I don't know if his father started because his father was a doctor. So maybe his grandfather started, or something.
It's a family business, but he's like, because they say it in an earlier scene, it's like, is that where you worked at? He's like, no, I work at the hospital. I let better men run the business. Better men than I to run the business.
So it seems as if one of Bruce's ancestors some Wayne started it.
Because without being said, the Waynes are a big part of Gotham. They've always been a big part of Gotham.
But his father has chosen to be a doctor.
Yes, to help people.
To help people. And they use their wealth and some of the money from the foundation, from the company to try to better the city.
Yeah, and their influence and stuff like that.
This is when we're introduced to Jonathan Crane, a.k.a. Scarecrow.
And Rachel Dawes.
We see her again.
Adult Dawes, or adultish, more adult.
More adult Dawes.
Yes. And then a nice little random courtroom scene where Dawes is declaring a minor Batman villain insane, Victor Zsasz. He tally marks all of his victims on his body, so he's got like scars of tally marks all over because he's a psychopath. We kind of get a sense that Crane is corrupt, runs Arkham Asylum, and he's in the pocket of Falcone and declares all of his people that get caught insane, so they go have a little cushy stay at Arkham and go into an actual prison.
Cillian Murphy's portrayal here of Jonathan Crane, I thought was pretty perfect, because in one quick scene of them, Rachel's kind of a pit bull. Yeah, and she's laying into him, basically, like, just, I know you're corrupt.
Yeah.
And I'm going to find out that you're corrupt, and you're just, you're whatever. She confronts him, and he's disturbing. Just the way he takes off his glasses, his mannerisms, the way that he speaks. It's very clear from the first instance you see this guy, he's some sort of a psycho.
Yeah, he's messed up.
Yeah.
He enjoys crazy. Like, that's his world. He enjoys it. He is a psychotherapist. So, like, that's his world.
We also get it revealed to us that Rachel has had a previous relationship with her boss, with the district attorney. Bruce sees them interacting. He's come back. Nobody knows he's back yet. And he's watching her from afar.
He's a
creeper. Yeah. And he's kind of heartbroken is the sense that we get, because he's in love with her. When did it turn romantic? Because he really wasn't. He was in prep school, then he went to college, and then he was in Asia somewhere.
Like a big chunk of his life, he's gone.
Yeah. When did they fall in love?
As children, maybe? But you don't really see that. I mean, we didn't need the romantic aspect of it. I think a closeness or a friendship bond would have been enough.
Unless they planned on killing her from the very beginning to add tragedy to his character.
He has enough tragedy, don't
you think? You got to be able to kill somebody, though. The Joker has to be able to kill somebody close. You're not going to kill Alfred. You're not going to kill Bruce. So she was a character specifically created for these movies.
I still think you'd get that emotional thing.
She was a friend.
Like she's his best friend without actually having the romantic thing in there.
Katie Holmes isn't the world's best actress.
She felt had no emotion in that movie, really.
Because most of her scenes are her confronting people or her chastising people, kind of like calling people to the carpet, including Bruce. Like she's, and with her emotionless,
Yeah, you felt no anger.
Performance?
No, you didn't feel
it. Ends up just feeling like she's a very harsh person. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Like
it's not nuance. It's sort of a one-note performance, and it's a one-note character where it's just like, your father would be disappointed in you, Bruce, you know, over and over.
A break. His parents were murdered in front of him.
Yeah.
Cut him some slack. And then Bruce actually kind of reveals himself as being back, back to Wayne Enterprises and says, hey, I'm not here to make waves. I'm just looking for a job.
What do you have in mind? Applied sciences, where applied sciences, essentially all of their shelved R&D projects for the military. And Lucius Fox, who was a character that we've never seen before. We saw in the animated series.
In the animated series and big in the comic books.
Yep, but we've never seen him on screen before. He played by Morgan Freeman. And he is a board member who has stayed true to the wishes of Thomas Wayne and for his...
He ruffled feathers.
Yeah, for his faithfulness, basically. Earl put him into this dead end.
Yeah.
It's a basement.
Yeah, he even says...
There's nothing to do.
It's like... What did Earl say this job was before you came down here? He didn't say much. He told me exactly what it is. Dead end.
Does this work for you? Because you, in a quote-unquote realistic Batman, you have to have some explanation as to where the heck this stuff comes from.
Where did you get all these wonderful toys?
Yes.
Yeah, I think it worked fine. It's believable. I mean, Wayne Enterprises is a company that develops things. We're still not sure like what their niche is in the corporate world. They just kind of like, they're building cars and armor and random things.
Well, that was that one department. Yeah, that was their R&D for the military.
Yeah.
They had other contracts. They built a monorail. They did transportation work.
Yeah, they did everything. They had their hands in everything.
So. Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah, I think it worked out well to just kind of give you a sense of like, he's not building this stuff in his cave. Like, a company actually made and developed this technology. I think it was. I'm trying not to compare this to the comics and the TV shows and everything that came before, because I'm trying to keep this in its contained own world. But they're also pulling that kind of source material. Like, I believe a lot of his tech did come from outside sources in the comic books and in the animated series. Like, a lot of it came from Wayne Enterprise.
This movie visually is a little bit different than the other ones. I don't think it had the budget that the second two had. Obviously, it wasn't IMAX stuff in it, I don't think. This one, there's a lot of sepia tone in this. There's a lot of copper, and it's kind of muddy.
Darker,
like brown.
Rust. Rusty kind of.
Brown. And a lot of his suit kind of matches that. And I thought that was pretty interesting. I don't know why they chose to move away that into more of a blue tint or more of just like a clean look for the second two films.
Yeah. City looks completely different.
It's a completely different city. Yeah.
That is one gripe I do have with you. It like the city doesn't have a continuity. Maybe it might have a different look from like The Dark Knight to Rises. I mean, you're talking about 8 years.
Yeah.
And everything's right.
Supposed to be cleaned up.
Yeah, the city's supposed to be prosperous and in better condition. I can probably see that, but going like a year from Begins to The Dark Knight, it's night and day.
The Batmobile being this really ugly looking weird tank.
Yeah.
And the biggest problem is you sit in the cockpit and it has basically rocket launchers and guns on it.
Yeah.
Which I don't know why he doesn't count those as guns. He has this policy of not using guns. He has no problem in any of these movies blowing cars up.
Look at the 89 had guns on it too.
Well, they didn't even mention the no gun rule in the 89. He was trying to shoot the Joker.
He was straight up murdering people.
Yeah, dropping bombs and driving away. The cockpit, the seat has to slide over, slide down, and then you take this laying position to fire. That seems so impractical.
And why? Why do you need to do that?
I don't know why you couldn't just fire the gun or shoot a bridge or anything from the regular seated position.
Yeah, because he has the same controls.
It doesn't feel
like a Batmobile. It never felt like a Batmobile.
The Bat vehicles don't match the realistic Batman you're trying to create.
Or at least, you know, just get like a hypercar. Like, you've heard of supercars or sports cars. Like,
yes.
A hypercar is above a supercar. It's like insane sports car.
Right.
It's like the most insane Lamborghini that's ever made. It's like Bugatti Veyron's like considered almost like a hypercar. Like, super fast. Take one of those cars and just kind of put like armor on it. Like, take a realistic supercar and armorize it.
The cape ends up getting used because basically he is trying to find an ally to get intel
from the police.
From the police. And he knows that most of the police are corrupt, but he remembers when he was a young man, there was one police officer who was kind towards him, who put his coat on him when he was a child. And so he spies on him to see if he's still a good cop.
Yeah.
And he determines he is a good cop. And so he pretends to hold him hostage with a stapler,
yes,
in his office. And that is a sergeant. Is he sergeant? Yeah.
He's a sergeant.
Sergeant James Gordon.
Yeah.
He basically tries to get information on what would it take to bring the mob down.
You know, Falcone specifically.
Yeah. What would it take to bring Falcone down? Why does nothing stick? And it basically, Gordon tells him he owns the cops and he owns the one judge. The judge, Faden.
Yes.
And
you need to get leverage on Faden, and you need a prosecutor willing to, crazy enough to prosecute.
Rachel Dawes. He gives him Rachel's name, and he essentially says, wait for my sign. What sign? Gordon goes to chase him, and Bruce has to jump across the building to get away from the police so he's not discovered, because he doesn't have the cow yet.
Yeah, he has a ski mask.
So actually, like,
there was another cool line he did. He's like, you're just one man? And he's like, now two. This is another thing that I like about this as being a great Batman movie, is it has that Batman and Gordon relationship.
Yes.
Gordon and Batman are working together. Gordon actually does something in this movie.
Except for, you know,
turning on the bat signal.
In his pajamas.
In his pajamas.
Well, looks like the Red Triangle Gang's back in town. Batman!
Yeah!
Go get him!
Thanks, Gordon.
Thanks, Gordon. Go back to bed. I got this. Have another donut, Gordo. Me and this 50-year-old kid. This 70-year-old orphan that you brought to me to raise.
This homeless 50-year-old man that I need to be a guardian for.
You think as a child?
So child services don't come get him.
You wanted to keep him out of danger, so I just gave him a superhero suit. I'm going to take him to face his parents' killer without any training. So the cape comes about because he needs to be able to jump.
Glide
without killing himself, because he really hurts himself.
Yeah, because he hits a fire escape hard.
Hard.
And breaks it.
And what's really interesting is the cape material that they use in the movie, where it basically you can conform it to any shape you want. And if you run a current through it, it becomes rigid enough to be able to like become a gliding material, but it's also loose.
Yeah.
That's a real material.
Yeah.
They based it off of a very real thing that is actually in use for different stuff.
So we get Batman's basically fully suited up, and we see him go on his first vigilante assignment that he assigns himself. He's going to the docks to take out Falcone's shipment of drugs coming in, which I really like this scene at first. I mean, I still like this scene because it plays into that whole ninja thing with not being seen and fighting from the shadows. It's tense because the music is like very subtle and some of the tones playing in there.
It's almost like a horror movie, the way this is shot.
Like, people are just like being ripped from random spots. Like, it's like, how is he getting from point A to point B so quickly?
Right. And some people are like going up and going sideways. They're just
being just like taken out one by one.
Yeah. Like a monster's taking them out.
Yeah. And guys are freaking out and just running around and shooting guns randomly. It's a really cool scene. And I love this part when the guy's like freaking out with his little submachine gun, and he's just like firing it off. He's like, where are you? And you see that cool upside down Batman saying, here. Like, that's something from the comics.
Yes.
That's something from the Arkham video games, where he's inverted and takes out a criminal. So he takes out all the thugs. Gordon's partner he's there as security. He books out and he takes out Falcone. And You get the classic line of, who are you? And he just breaks through his car and just, like, knocks him out and says, I'm Batman.
That line doesn't really mean anything anymore. But leading up to this reboot, Batman Begins 2005. In 2005, one of my biggest questions was, are they going to use the line, I'm Batman? Because that, the Keaton delivery in 89, that whole exchange, like, what are you? I'm Batman. Was like, that's like a definitive Batman move, like,
yeah, it's Batman thing. Movie. Yeah, you have to say it.
Yes, it's a definitive thing, and that was a really big catchphrase from the 89 movie, and so you were wondering, are they going to reference that? And I remember when I was in the theater erupted when he did that.
See, the thing about that line in this movie for me is not just for, like, the fans of 89, like, just the classic I'm Batman line. I think it's also a statement for, I'm finally now Batman. When fan service works not just for the fans, it works in the context of the movie, I like that a little bit more.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't just feel like, oh, we need to throw this in there for the fans.
And I was watching this movie. That was one of, like, a bunch of different little things that they did in this movie that I wish they would have continued in the other films.
Yeah.
We never see him do anything like that again. Although in Dark Knight Rises, when they're going through the tunnels, he does the upside down thing again. They play it the exact same way where she says,
yeah,
he's coming. Where? Here. He does it again.
Right, yeah.
But
he uses that cape.
Yes, but we never see him, like, just
being Batman.
Being Batman.
After that, Batman gets Rachel. She gets mugged or attempted a fake mugging where the thugs are trying to kill her.
Yeah, Crane tells Falcone that she's sniffing around.
We need to take her out because she's.
And Falcone wants to buy her off.
Yeah,
and this won't work with this one.
She's idealist, but Batman saves her and gives her the leverage on the judge.
We go back to the docks. And Falcone is actually tied to a searchlight.
It looks like a mock-up of the bat symbol.
What did you think about the origin of the bat symbol? It's different than 89, where Batman writes a letter to the city, and Gordon's, how do you plan on getting a hold of him? He gave us a sign!
Yeah, I thought it was all right. I thought, like, when I first saw it, I was like, it's a bat symbol, that's cool. Because, like, I don't know, watching this is like, this is supposed to be a more realistic, gritty take. I mean, you're going to think, like, are they going to do a bat signal? Like,
yeah.
Is this going to appear in it? Because it's not really practical. Like, you put a symbol on a spotlight and shoot up in there, it's not going to look like a bat. It's just going to kind of, like, blend in together.
The explanation they give for it in The Dark Knight, I think, is pretty good. It's Gordon basically says it's not really for Batman.
Just a reminder that he's out there.
Yeah, it's an intimidation tactic.
Yeah.
Basically.
He doesn't come every night.
So we also get this scene where essentially this terrorist group that we're not sure who they are takes over a boat that has some Wayne Enterprises technology on it.
Yeah, I think it's a Wayne, probably just like a Wayne Enterprises boat.
They break into it and they steal a microwave EMP, basically.
Yeah, it vaporizes water.
And the purpose of it was to, you could vaporize your enemy's water supply during combat.
Which sounds very cruel.
At this point, Earl is basically trying to get more information on it. Lucius asks one too many questions, and he's fired.
Yeah, he's fired. It's like, give me all this information, put it on my desk, and by the way,
you're fired.
You're fired. If you're a fox and you just got fired, would you do any of that? I mean, would you gather all this information for Earl?
That's a good point. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd be like, if I'm fired, you find it.
Yeah, that's a really good point. Yeah, I don't work here anymore. That's a really good point.
Way to motivate your employees.
So Falcone, since he got arrested,
yeah,
Crane's got him at Arkham.
Well, not yet. He's in a holding cell. He slits his wrists.
Yes.
Trying to get an insanity plea to get moved to Arkham because he has Crane in his, or he thinks he has Crane in his pocket.
And Falcone basically says, if you don't get me out of this,
I'm going to squeal,
and I'm going to tell everybody what you're doing in that nut house of yours. Crane decides to gas him, and this is the first real reveal that we get of the Scarecrow.
Yes.
He says, I don't really like this mask, which I thought was another way to undercut, like, why would we go around with the Scarecrow mask? But he said, I don't really like this mask, but my patients find it very effective.
The crazies.
Yeah, the crazies find it effective.
It's a freaky looking mask.
It is freaky. And he gasses him. And that the gas drives Falcone insane for real.
Yeah.
And Rachel Dawes is trying to figure out how in the world has this guy gone from sane to insane? And if he is insane, what did Crane do to him?
Because Crane did eventually move him to Arkham. Because now he's at Arkham.
Yes.
This is when Rachel wants an outside source to analyze.
And he's like, oh, okay, yeah, you can bring somebody in. Follow me. And they go to the basement. Now, the moment I got into an elevator with this man who is clearly a psychotic, and he puts a special key into this special lock that goes to the secret floor of this insane asylum, I'm getting off that elevator.
Yeah, I'm like, no.
They get down to the basement, and it's revealed that he has this militia down there that they're just taking giant drums of some sort of a chemical, and they're dumping it into a huge water main that ends up basically going into the rest of the city.
Yeah, he gasses her with what he says is a concentrated dose. And it's supposed to be, I don't know, this gas seems to affect everybody differently. Like, kind of put Bruce to sleep, almost kills Rachel, makes Falcone go insane.
Well, it
shows your fears.
It's a fear toxin.
It's a fear toxin.
So it really depends upon your own psyche.
Yeah. We never really see what Rachel sees. She's just kind of like Twilight, terrified, like wide-eyed and freaked out.
This, to me, is the most Batman thing in any of these movies. Because he comes down from the ceiling.
Yeah.
His cape is unfurled. And he comes down. He takes a bunch of the henchmen. Well, actually, the lights go out first.
The lights go out first. And then Crane's like, he's here.
And they're like, who? The Batman.
Crane's...
Basically, the Arkham Asylum games are built on this one scene of this movie, really.
And Crane tries to dose him with this fear toxin again, but Batman's a little bit too quick for him this time and doses himself.
So now Crane is basically going insane, and he sees Batman as a demon.
Yeah, he's like oozing stuff out of his mouth.
Black goo from Prometheus is just pouring out of his mouth, and he's a demon.
Yeah.
And his horns are actually like horns.
Yeah. He looks more like a man bat kind of thing, like a fusion of the two.
I guess. He's kind of a monster. He doesn't quite look like a bat. He's basically saying, who do you work for?
And he says, Ra's al Ghul. He says,
Ra's al Ghul is dead. I watched him die. I'm sorry, Dr. Crane's not in right now.
Yes.
If you'd like to leave an appointment, please leave a message. Here's my favorite thing that he does, though.
Okay.
The problem is, in the meantime, the police have surrounded Arkham, and Batman is a criminal.
Yes.
So
he's a vigilante.
They want to take Batman down, and they want to take you.
Because the commissioner earlier says, no man takes the law into their own hands. We're going after the Batman. Before that, the only person willing to go into the building is Gordon.
That's correct.
Everybody else was kind of waiting for SWAT to show up.
Gordon's like, how are you going to get out of here? And he pulls a little transmitter off of his boot, and it's like echolocation.
Yeah.
And he pushes a button, and every bat in the city of Gotham comes and swarms in this place to get to that signal.
Yeah, that sound.
And he uses it as a distraction to get out. I freaking loved this in 2005, and I loved it when I saw it again, because it's been forever.
It's an amazing shot, too, because, like, Gordon takes Rachel out, and then, like, you see SWAT finally coming in, going up the stairs, the spiral staircase, and all these bats just come rushing in, and Batman just drops.
Yes.
From the top floor, using his cape. It just, like, that's Batman. And then he pulls out bombs off his utility belt, throw it to get out the building.
Yes. It's Batman.
It's Batman. This is, like, comic book Batman.
Yes.
This is animated series Batman stuff you're seeing. You get the fun chase scene with the tumbler. What does the tumbler not hit? This thing hits everything.
Yeah, cop cars are flying, lots of property damage, churches are destroyed, bridges are destroyed.
Everything. You know, the one thing I didn't like about the chase scene was stealth mode. All he did was turn the lights on.
How does a giant tank disappear?
Yeah, and then it's passing past cop cars that are behind it, like he's slowing, and then all of a sudden he just turns it back on. I'm like, why did you do that?
I love the fact that he basically goes roaring back to Wayne Manor and jumps, because that's what the vehicle was built for, rocket jumps, which gives an explanation of why they have a rocket booster on the back of the Batmobile. Because it's supposed
to jump rivers.
And he just jumps through the waterfall and lands.
You know what was cool?
It's
thing?
A good scene.
The cool thing I thought about when he was going back to the Batcave in Wayne Manor and going through the forest, it felt like Batman 89.
He's there, and it just so happens it's Bruce Wayne's 30th birthday party, and Alfred is pissed because he's running around being Batman. creating a spectacle and saying, you said you wanted to be inconspicuous. I mean, he basically asked, like, what didn't you destroy out there?
Yeah.
Hot rod or whatever.
What do you call that? It's like, that's good television.
Yeah. Alfred, it was Rachel. I had to save my friend. And he's like, well, those, Bruce Wayne's got a party. Those are Bruce Wayne's guests up there. And this is the point where this Bruce Wayne's basically, I don't care about Bruce Wayne. I don't care about my family name. I don't care about this house. I don't care about these people. I got to save this city. Rachel's sick. I got to find Lucius. So he puts on a tuxedo real quick, runs and finds Lucius, who's there with all these other sycophants.
Because Lucius made him an antidote for the fear toxin.
Yes.
And he only made like a couple doses.
Yeah.
One he used for Rachel, and he only has one left.
How much easier would it have been? I'm going to go back to that scene we skipped, the first confrontation in the Narrows with the Scarecrow. How much easier would it have been if John Blake would have been that orphan, that kid? The kid's from an abusive family. When Batman's doing the intel, which is also a very Batman thing to do.
Yeah.
He's got the night vision goggles, and the kid's like, oh, I told my friends you were real. Yeah. And he gives him the night vision goggles.
None of my friends will believe me.
Yes. Yeah. He gives him the night vision goggles. How much more powerful would it have been if in Dark Knight Rises, during that confrontation with Bruce, where he confronts him as being Batman, if at the very end of that scene, he put the night vision goggles on his desk.
I think it would have been it would have tied it together better. Or you could have changed his name to like Tim Drake.
Lucius runs off to make more of the antidote. And this old lady comes up to Bruce.
Bruce,
I must. I actually like this. I have to introduce you to somebody. Am I pronouncing this right? Is it Ra's al Ghul? And you can see that Bruce is not paying any attention to her, but when he hears the name, he looks. And it's just some other random Asian guy.
Yeah. You're like,
you're not Ra's al Ghul. I watched him die. aren't his ways mysterious? And it's revealed that Liam Neeson, aka Ducard, has actually been Ra's al Ghul the entire time. So the confrontation is basically like Bruce now has this house full of wealthy guests that Lee wants to kill. These are the people he wants to kill. How the heck is Bruce going to get these people out of there? So he pretends like he's drunk and he insults them all until they leave.
Get out of my house.
Basically ruining the Wayne name. I really like with it when all these people are dispersing, you just see like 1 in 10 people not move.
Yeah, and they're just staring right.
And they're just staring. You realize that's a league member. That's a league member. Because we've never seen any of their faces. They all had the ninjutsu mask. Ra's explains to him, basically every collapse of civilization, we caused it. And we were bringing Gotham to its knees. And as civilization evolved, so have our tactics. And we chose a new one, economics. But it turns out that the depression that Gotham had been facing
was caused by the League.
And the only thing that spared it was the work of Thomas Wayne. But then their murders galvanized the wealthy people in the city just enough to basically keep the city afloat. The genius of it is, unlike Batman 89, where they just said, the Joker killed your parents, they got to the exact same point, but just in a different way that was still true to the comics. And that's genius. That's genius writing. Because Joe Chill's dead.
So he can't take his vengeance on that guy because he's gone.
Yes.
But he can take his vengeance on Ra's.
He and Ra's get into a conflict. A beam ends up falling on him.
Yeah.
And Bruce says to him, I saved your life. And he says, you burned my house to the ground and left me for dead. Consider us even. And leaves him. And it's so cold.
It is so cold, but not really even.
No,
because
you should have taken him outside at least.
Yeah, leave him with like some guy and it's like nurse him back to health
and then kill him.
We find out the League has the microwave thing,
vaporizer,
and starts releasing fear toxin in the Narrows.
Here's what I thought was going to happen in 2005. They need an explanation for supervillains because this is a real logical Batman movie.
Yeah. So, they needed crazies.
My thought was between that and something that happens is as the people of the Narrows are gassed, they look up and they see Batman gliding over them and he looks like a demon. His eyes are glowing and he's like growling and
his mouth is
glowing. Yeah. His mouth is glowing and they're all terrified of him. Everybody's terrified of Batman. I thought this was going to accomplish something. That all the supervillains that we were going to get, the Joker, whoever else that was going to come up in these movies, they were in Arkham or they were from the Narrows, and they were already either crazy or criminals or whatever, and they were further driven insane by the toxin. And they had a primal fear of Batman built into them from this experience. So they look up and they see him, because that's like in the comic book, the whole thing is superstitious, cowardly lot, you know. The old school Batman. Criminals are superstitious and cowardly. So if I dress like my fear, which is a bat, they'll be afraid of me. Well, in the real world, if you saw a man dressed as a bat, you wouldn't be afraid of him. But if you were traumatized by the image of a bat and driven insane, you would be terrified of a bat. So I thought, this is laying the groundwork for everything to come.
The Rogues Gallery.
Yeah, the Rogues Gallery. That's it. It's never mentioned again.
Nope.
Gordon, in this movie, says the Narrows is lost, and they never go back to the Narrows. And I thought, in The Dark Knight Rises, Bane turns the city's criminals and the city's poor against the wealthy and the corrupt. Wouldn't it have made sense if, in the second movie, they shut the Narrows off and just kind of left those people to do whatever, pretend like the problem didn't exist? And what if the in the second film, the people that we see in Batman Begins underneath the city and the people who lived in the Narrows, what if they become Bane's militia?
Instead of using Blackgate Prison as that, use Arkham Asylum. You shun the city, this section of the city, rise and take it back.
Yes.
Yeah, it would make more sense. Instead of we get a prison that we didn't hear about in any other movie. So the League's plan is to take this microwave emitter and drive it down the train to Wayne Tower, which is the central hub.
I will say that at this point, we're about an hour and 55 minutes in, and I'm beginning to feel the length of the movie.
Yeah. This is where Gordon starts to team up with Batman, because he's like, I need your help. Take my wheels. So Gordon's supposed to blow the track off, which I don't know why he has to go all the way to the central hub to do that. Like,
that's a good point.
Why couldn't he just like do that anywhere in front of the train?
That's a really good point, Pat.
So like he could have just blown it up.
It makes a good tension filled scene, because we have like the engineers or whatever who are like, oh my god, the city's gonna blow.
I'm narrating what's happening to you.
Yeah, their exposition.
Yeah.
If that body rail reaches 88 miles an hour, you're going to see something serious.
Doc is working as a city engineer. You get a nice close quarter combat between Batman and Roz on the train. And he does give you a line. It's like, don't you have anything new? Very predictable. And he's like, how about this? And does something new.
Yes.
Breaks his sword. I like this line. It's like, I don't have to kill you, but also I don't have to save you. I thought that was a cool line.
Is that a cop-out?
It's a technicality.
I can't kill you, but I don't have to save you.
But you're letting somebody die.
But yeah, you're directly causing their death, or directly allowing their death.
Yeah. Who's directly killing him? Is it Bruce for not saving him, or Gordon blowing up the track?
Or himself for causing all of this.
Yeah.
It's a slippery slope, Pat.
Yeah.
The politics of Batman not killing people don't always make a lot of sense, I don't think.
No. Especially in movies. I think they kind of do a little bit better in the comics of him not killing people.
There was a lot of speculation on the internet at the time that he wasn't dead, that he was going to come back via the Lazarus Pit or something that Nolan was going to create as some realistic explanation. Did you think he was dead? Or were you unsure?
I'm going to say no. I didn't think he was dead because of what I knew about Ra's or Ra's al Ghul from comics and the TV series.
Wayne Manor is completely burned to the ground. And Rachel's there, he's picking through, he finds some photographs, and he finds his father's stethoscope. And it's this flashback that has repeatedly throughout the movie, and also in The Dark Knight Rises. And it's his father playing with him with the stethoscope. I find that really touching, man. I think the score for this first one is really good.
Yeah.
I really enjoy, it's sad, this is very effective. It brings a little tear to my eye. And Rachel essentially says, the man that I love, Bruce Wayne, he's never coming back.
Yeah,
and maybe one day,
when you don't need Batman
anymore. When the city and you don't need Batman anymore, we can be together. The next scene, what is the Gordon scene? He's got the bat signal, and Batman arrives at the top of Major Crimes. He's now Lieutenant Gordon.
Lieutenant, yep. Got a promotion for blowing up a train track.
For causing mass destruction?
That's how you do it.
That's how you do it. And it is revealed that there's a person who has a flair for the dramatic.
Just like you.
Just like you. And they have a brief exchange about escalation.
Yeah.
Where
yeah,
he's like, we carry automatics, they have machine guns, we wear bulletproof vests, they have armor-piercing rounds. And Bruce is like, and he's like, and there's you, and...
Take a look at this guy.
Yeah. And it's the Joker's card.
Yeah, double homicide, armed robbery.
Flair for the dramatic. This is his calling card. And I love the line, because Batman doesn't know anything about this person.
Yeah.
And I love that, because we hardly ever get to see Batman before the Joker. So what's Batman in a world where the Joker already exists?
Yeah.
And he goes, I'll look into it.
He glides with me.
And I didn't get a chance to thank you, and you'll never have to. So here's my question. What was your reaction in 2005 when they flipped that card over and it's the Joker?
I was excited. I was like, this is going to be awesome.
I love that moment.
I do too. I still love that moment.
I still do.
Like, that's that scene of Batman and Gordon on the rooftop talking next to the Bat Signal. It's a cool scene. It's like, I keep saying it over and over and over again. It's like from the animated series and it's from the comics. Like, it's what they did.
That's the highest compliment you could pay, though.
Yeah.
So let me challenge you then. Why wouldn't you rank Batman Begins as better than The Dark Knight?
It's
because we've went through this whole movie
and
you've had almost no criticisms for it. We've nitpicked every movie we've ever talked about in the history of the show, all seven episodes, you know, the 4 months we've been doing this. We have not nitpicked this. We nitpicked The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah. I did say I had a hard time between The Dark Knight and this.
What puts the other one above this?
I agree with you. This is a better Batman movie. From a movie standpoint, I think The Dark Knight is a better movie. It's better. It's shot better. It has better ways it's shot. I love Heath Ledger's performance as the Joker. It blew me away in 2008 when that came out. Those are the only reasons. Like, and it's like barely.
I'm not in disagreement with you. I'm not in disagreement with you at all. But to me, I just, even all that being said, this is the better movie of the franchise. Because it's the one that, this movie isn't called The Joker Rises or the Trilogy, the Dark Joker Trilogy. It's the Dark Knight Trilogy.
Yeah.
Only one of them did the Dark Knight service. Is the second one a better script? Yeah, probably. Is it a better story? Yeah, probably. Does it have better performances, better cinematography, better lighting? Yes to all that. But it's the Dark Knight Trilogy, and we're judging this franchise, and this is the best Batman story told on film yet.
But we're not a Batman podcast.
No.
We're a movie podcast.
But I'm judging the franchise based on its main character.
Okay.
Imagine if Temple of Doom barely had Indiana Jones in it, but it was a superior film in every other category. Yeah. I couldn't say that's a better movie than Raiders because the main character is barely in it. Batman's barely in The Dark Knight.
Yeah. I'm not disagreeing with you on those points.
I got you.
But I don't know. I like the Joker as a villain. He's like probably the best comic book villain ever created in my mind.
So let me ask you this question.
Okay.
Do you like the Joker more than you like Batman?
No, I don't. I like the Joker versus Batman. I like them two going head in head because they are basically like polar opposites of each other. And I like the fact that the Joker doesn't really want to kill Batman. He just wants to torture Batman because he's too much fun. I don't know.
Yeah, that's a great dynamic.
It is a great dynamic.
Yeah. It's a great dynamic, but these movies didn't create that dynamic.
No, it's definitely not.
So final grade for Batman Begins.
Batman Begins, I'm going with a 90% or a 9.
That's funny because you can see right here in my notes, we do not discuss this stuff in advance. 9.0.
I give it a higher rating than it's got on Rotten Tomatoes.
It's at 85%.
85%. I think I do feel that this movie is overlooked because of The Dark Knight.
Yes.
And I think people should go back and watch this movie. It's a really good movie.
Pat, is this the most morose, low-key episode that we've ever done? Like, since the beginning, if you go back and listen, which I don't recommend that you do, if you go back and listen to our first couple episodes, we're kind of figuring this thing out. Since tonight, we've had some pretty good energy, but Christopher Nolan seems to have just sucked the life out of us.
I'm tired.
I need a nap. I need an enema. I need a noose.
Need some pills.
I need pills. I need uppers, flim flams, downers,
fuzzy zips, and
quip quaps.
Husker do's and Husker don't. Thanks for listening to the show. You can send us your thoughts on this movie to patandjasonpod@gmail.com. We may read your thoughts on a future episode. Like us on Facebook at facebook.com/patandjasonpodcast. And follow us on Twitter @patandjason. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, or your favorite podcast app. We have a new episode every other Wednesday.
While you're at it, please rate and review us on iTunes. Those reviews really do help out the show. Next week's franchise will be the Cornetto Trilogy, and we'll be reviewing Hot Fuzz, which currently holds 91% Rotten Tomatoes.